看呗。Hi, my name is Joanne and I am an alcoholic. My sober date is May 11th, 1994. I celebrated 8 years this past weekend. I didn't really celebrate. I just went to a big book meeting actually last night because I always try to get to a meeting on my anniversary, regardless of where I am. Last year I happened to be whitewater rafting on the Youghiogheny, and it took me about 2 hours to find a meeting in Somerset County, as it was, in Pennsylvania. But I did get to a meeting, and it was wonderful. And this year I celebrated in Lehigh Valley, where I live now, in Allentown, at a big book meeting. I celebrated kind of last night. I started last year, last summer. I accepted a commitment to a rehab. I guess it's a parole rehab. People who are in jail are offered the opportunity to go to this rehab, and they're from all over the United States, but pretty much from the Pennsylvania area. And we're the first people to take a big book meeting there. So I go in there with some of the women I sponsor and some of my friends, and we share with them our experience, strength, and hope from the big book. So last night, and it's kind of traditional for us to go out to dinner first, so a bunch of my proteges took me out to dinner last night. So that was really my celebration, and my sponsor brought me dinner tonight, so I'm really making out well. And the fellowship is the important part. It's always nice to go out to a meal with people who are on this path with us, and you know, share what's going on in our lives and the blessings we have, and what's going, and you know, how things are starting to grow for us. And as I shared last week, when I moved to the Lehigh Valley, it was kind of hard for me because I was a fish out of water, and it was hard to find a meeting that, you know, stood up to my great Berkeley Heights Into Action group, which had been my home group for a couple of years. And I started to really get connected once I started to sponsor people out there. And I kind of followed them around to meetings because I didn't know what meetings to go to anyway. So it was kind of the opposite of the way, you know, it's supposed to work, where, you know, most people carry the alcoholic to the message. And that's how they end up carrying this message. And actually, I was carrying this message while I was following them around to whatever meeting they went to. So it's a little different. But other than one of my basic rules is that, you know, if it's in the big book, it's in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you can't find it in the big book, maybe it's good advice, maybe it isn't. I don't have any proof. But one of the great things that I love about the way the big book is laid out and the program is laid out, and it was one of the things that Brenda had said earlier, because she had said when she went to rehab, she didn't know what was going to happen. She didn't know what the results would be. And one of the things that they do for us over and over and over again in our book and in a lot of our literature is to tell us what's going to happen if we do what it says, if we follow the directions. And then, sometimes like with the third step, afterwards come the warnings, which is really kind of fun. Because it's almost like they do the sales job and they say, well, you know, it's like, these are all the great things you're going to get if you do this, and this is how you do it. And, by the way, you know, these things might happen also. Tonight I'm going to share about steps 3, 4, and 5. Just in case people weren't here last week, I am a drunk. I drank a lot. I told a couple of stories last week to confirm that for anyone who didn't believe it. It's very difficult once someone's sober for a while to look at them and realize that they were once that, as it says, and I love this line, it says, a trembling, despairing wreck. And that's what I was when I got here. Actually, Alcoholics Anonymous came to get me. I had married my best drinking partner ever. We lived very well. We lived in Westfield, New Jersey, which is a very affluent town, in a very big house. You know, we had a Jaguar and a Mercedes. He had a good job. I had a good job. But as things around us started to physically fall apart as far as that, you know, shell of success, his family started to, his family was the first to notice. Basically, I started withdrawing from people so that things wouldn't be too apparent. And his sister, my sister-in-law, had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she determined that her brother needed it too. And she arranged an intervention for him and excluded me because she saw me as part of the problem. Well, this really ticked me off because, you know, I knew that he had a problem. And I also knew that it wasn't, you know, I didn't have it either, you know. And what happened was I was able to, he ended up going to rehab. And while he was there, I furthered my belief in the lie by stopping drinking for that time period. It was not fun at all. But I determined that I could do this on my own willpower. But you know what? I didn't like it. I really didn't like it. And I always have to remember that when I think about how I can describe this to another person when I'm working with them, because that's what I have to remember, was how I felt inside. And I found out when I was working step one that that's the unmanageability part, that awful, awful, awful feeling that I was left with inside when I took that alcohol away and I had nothing to replace it. And that was, for me, the beginning of finding out how powerless I was over alcohol. Because once I did start drinking again, because I did, I couldn't stay stopped, you know. Once I started drinking again, I then started to really notice, because I had a little bit of an exposure of to Al-Anon, because I went to the family program on my, he's now my ex, was in the rehab. I started to see the manifestation of how uncontrolled my drinking was and how insatiable it was and how much it controlled me. And that for me was the really scary part. So 10 months later, I entered rehab for the first time. I understood the step one part. I understood the step two part. I understood the step three part. And I came out and I started to go to meetings, and I got a sponsor, and I got a home group, and I celebrated my 90 days, and I spoke at the podium, and I did all the things that AA was telling me to do. And my sponsor, you know, told me that I needed to wait, you know, I needed to, you know, get calm and, you know, get things under control and all this kind of stuff, and then we'd start working the steps soon. And this is not meant to be an indictment of anyone else's program. This is just my personal story. And what happened was, after about 10 months of hanging on and hanging on and hanging on, I just couldn't stand it anymore because I was dying inside. And here I was without the thing that always fixed that for me, you know, and I didn't have anything else to replace it. And today I know that that's worked in this program, and that's the only thing that's ever worked for alcoholics, ever. You know, I mean, you can look in the Bible and you can see, you know, the description of an alcoholic in the Bible. Humankind has had this problem ever since forever, you know, I mean, the Old Testament. And nothing ever worked until Alcoholics Anonymous came along, and thank God I was born after it was invented, and I didn't have to suffer forever like all those other helpless alcoholics. But what happened was, because I wasn't working the program, I drank. I drank one Friday night, and I poured myself a really tall glass of vodka with a couple of ice cubes in it and a splash of orange juice on top. That's how I like to drink. To this day, I still can't drink orange juice because it just tastes funny, you know? You know, without that vodka in it, just doesn't taste right. So I still don't drink orange juice. Anyway, I drank one of those, and I drank another one, and I don't really remember a whole lot of what happened that night. I was still married to my husband at the time, and he never really could stay sober. So he was probably in and out of 5 or 6 rehabs at this point. And my life was, my insides were unmanageable, and my life was unbearable. I woke up the next morning, and I had this massive hangover. And being the good alcoholic, still of an alcoholic mind, I said, well, that's it. From now on, we're buying better vodka. Because he hadn't been working, so of course the only thing in the house had been the rot gut. So from that point on, whenever I wanted to drink, I went and I got some good stuff. That went on for about 6 months until alcohol, as they say, brought me to a state of reasonableness. God reached out his hand one morning and I woke up. I didn't know what day it was. I didn't know how many days it had been since I had gone to work. I didn't know whether or not I had called in the day before to tell them I wasn't coming. But I did call the rehab I had been in, and I talked to my counselor, and she said, I heard you're out there. Come on in. And I cried, and I said, I can't, because I had already been drinking. Or, you know, I said I had already been drinking, of course, because I couldn't be honest, you know. I just was stalling. And what I did was I got in the car, though, the next morning. And this rehab was 8 miles from my house, and I drove up there, and at that point, I was ready to work the steps. I knew from talking to Alice that that's what I needed to do, because we sat down that day and we talked about what had happened and what was going on and what went wrong. And she said, okay, what do you want to do? And I said, I just don't ever want to feel like this again. I don't want to drink anymore. And she said, okay, well, this is what you're going to have to do. We're going to have to work these steps. And I did, as they do in rehabs, I did this big written step one, I did a written step two, I did a written step three. After my first weekend, I was just doing my, I was just beginning to, you know, calm down. She hadn't given me any homework to do or anything yet, and I spent, because I drove up there on a Friday, and Saturday and Sunday, no counselors are there. And I can remember just listening to all these people talk about how they couldn't, you know, they were counting the days till they got out, you know, because a lot of them were there because they were trying to avoid going to jail or whatever, you know, and they just couldn't wait, you know, they were just counting their time till they could get out of the rehab. They weren't there because they wanted to get sober, and I got really resentful about that, because don't these people understand that this is what we're supposed to be here for? Because, of course, I knew what they needed. Yeah. Anyway, you know, so I expressed this to Alice on Monday morning. She just said to me, what are you here for? Are you here for them or are you here for you? And I said, well, you know, but they should. And she's like, are you here for them or are you here for you? And I said, I'm here for me. So, you know, that's something I always need to remember is, you know, if I don't stay sober and I don't do the things that I need to stay sober, nothing in my world around me is going to get better, you know. And that was a really important lesson for me, is that, you know, I need to work these steps for me and, you know, up until the point where I go out and make amends, and then, you know, I need to do that for them. I need to do the best I can to set those situations right. But I needed to do this for me, and I need to get sober for me and first. And so I did my 4th and 5th step while I was there also. And 6 and 7, and then left there doing my amends. So that's a little quickie on my personal history and a review of last week. Step one, basically for me, was coming to understand that I had a disease, that I wasn't just bad, that it wasn't a lack of moral fiber or a lack of character or a lack of willpower, but the fact that I have a disease that a lot of other people don't have. That, yes, I am different than other people. I didn't want to be different. I wanted to be like everybody else. I wanted to be like the other kids on the block. You know, I wanted to go out and play with them. You know, I wanted to go out to the bars when they went out to the bars. But you know what? I can't do it. Because it's just like if a diabetic wanted to eat a whole chocolate cake. You know, if they can't, they can't. You know, and it's like me, I can't drink one drink because if I drink that one drink, what happens is it sets off a physical craving in my body. And when I found that out, it was such a relief to know that it was a physical disease, that it wasn't, that I was bad. You know, for so long I just thought that there was just something wrong with me, that I just couldn't be a good person. You know, and I suffered with that guilt for so long until I found out that I have a disease. And then finding out that I needed the help of a higher power to overcome the mental obsession that always drove me back to drink, that was step two. And the question was, you know, really, having understood this disease and that I'm powerless over the alcohol on my own, because what happens is, if I take the drink, I don't know how much I'm going to drink. If I try to control how much I'm drinking, I'm not going to enjoy it. And that was the part that really, really stunk, you know? Because I wanted to be like other people. I wanted to be able to control my drinking and enjoy it. Well, that won't ever happen for me. It won't. And I had to accept that. So acceptance was the beginning, you know, acceptance of that fact. You know, it's like telling somebody, you know, that they've got cancer and they're going to have to undergo chemotherapy and all their hair's going to fall out and all those horrible things that are going to happen. You know, I've got alcoholism and, you know, what's the worst that can happen? I get to be friends with all you wonderful people, you know, but I didn't see it that way then, you know. I just, because all I knew was drinking, and I kept believing the lie that I was going to be able to enjoy my drinking one more time. I kept believing that lie, you know, and when I would go without drinking for a while, I was always left, you know, when, you know, they say when you take the alcohol out of the alcoholic, all you're left with is the ick, you know, and I just couldn't live in the ick. You know, so now the question was, you know, that of course is the mental obsession, because we believe that part that we can one more time enjoy our drinking and not get into trouble. So that's what drives us back. Even though we've been able to stop for a while, we get driven back. And the other thing that drove me back was the spiritual malady. And the spiritual malady for me was that feeling of not being good enough, not being afraid of people, not knowing if people liked me, able to listening to them thinking at me. I love that one. You know, I could hear them thinking at me, you know. And I knew it wasn't good. And, you know, just being scared. Just being scared, you know, and it wasn't just scared, it was paranoid, you know, those days when, you know, not wanting to answer the door, I never answered the phone anymore. You know, the answering machine picked it up, and then I decided if I was going to A, get the messages, or B, call them back, whoever it was. I was completely isolated from my family. I really didn't have any friends left. I had people that I knew would be at a bar, at a certain bar at a certain time. You know, I had those kind of friends. That spiritual malady, that was the real part that I really just couldn't live with. And the remorse and the guilt over all the things that I knew I had done wrong, that I just didn't know what to do about them. And I certainly had too much pride to go and admit it to anyone, you know, because I was right. You know, I had that self-justification as well as the self-pity, you know. I knew that, you know, God had inflicted this on me because I was bad. This was my punishment. You know, all the stuff that I had pulled, this was my punishment. And to understand that I have a disease wiped all that away, and it was such a relief. But then I had to get something to help me overcome all the ick. And that was step two. And step two was, you know, coming to believe in the God of my understanding, and that he could give me the power to get past all of that powerlessness over the alcohol, that thing that would always drive me back to taking that first drink. So, here I have a choice. Now we're at step three, finally. Step three is our choice. we have to choose. We have to be willing to make a choice. You know, do we want to continue with the old belief system, which is that, yes, I'm powerless over alcohol, because that's what I really believe was, I'm powerless over alcohol, there's nothing I can do about it, I'm just going to die this way. You know? Or B, two, if I can get some access to this power greater than myself that I call God, because I'm comfortable with that word, it certainly isn't the God that I had a concept of when I was 12 or 22 or even 32 or 38 when I first got here. It changes for me as my relationship with him grows. But back then, it was something greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. And that would be the sanity of not needing to go and get that drink, being able to live in my own skin. So that was the choice. Well, for me, of course, the choice was easy because I knew that I couldn't live the way I was living, that I was going to, I didn't want to die, and I didn't want to continue to live that way. So for me, the choice was easy. So I did step three. I said the prayer. I said, God, you know, please come and help me. And that's basically what it was. You know, I wasn't sitting there with the big book. You know, I wasn't with somebody who was reading the big book with me. I certainly didn't do all of the work right out of there or from the get-go. But I did the start. I started and I said, God, please help me. Forgive me for everything I've done and help me with this. And I can remember for weeks after that, if I could just sit and close my eyes and think about God and try to determine what my concept of it was, because I worked really hard at that one. You know, I think I worked at that a little too hard, but I think a lot of alcoholics do that, you know, because we got to get it all. We got to figure it all out. And, you know, I was trying to figure out, you know, so what's God? So what is it? What is it? How, what kind of God do I have? And what's my concept of a higher power? And, you know, I kind of was in that for a while, but I would just try to sit quietly and think of, you know, if I could imagine the best friend in the world, what would I want that to be? And I started with that. And I can remember sitting quietly and feeling the way I could remember feeling when I was about 3 years old and my daddy used to take me into his lap, and I would just feel really secure and loved and comforted. And it was this real physical feeling that I had when I took step three. And I can go there in meditation now when I feel scared. You know, I try to go back to that place where I felt that, go back to that place in my mind, in my heart. And for me, that was the essence of step three, because really, it was a decision for me to go forward with the rest of the steps, because I knew, because I was looking at this woman who I knew, this woman Alice, who I knew 17 years before, had been where I was sitting. You know, she felt that way. She drank the way I did. And certainly her life was a bigger mess than mine was, you know. And she was filled with the joy of life, you know. Her eyes sparkled, and she was just happy to be alive. And you could tell that everything that she did, she loved doing, and she enjoyed it. You know, regardless, I mean, not that everything in her life was perfect, not that she had the perfect husband or the perfect kids, or but she had, you know, everything in her life, she enjoyed everything in her life. And that's what I wanted. I just wanted to be happy, you know? And I thought that if I could do the steps, that that would happen for me. Maybe I could have a little piece of that too. So I made the decision and I said, all right, God, please take my will. Take my thoughts, take my actions. What do I have to do? So, you know, it doesn't mean that I give up my willpower, because willpower is what keeps me coming to AA meetings, you know. Willpower is what, you know, made me drive across the state of New Jersey tonight from Pennsylvania. Willpower is what, you know, when I moved to Lehigh Valley, willpower is what, you know, made me go into a dozen different AA rooms where I knew nobody and sit there and stick my hand out, you know. Willpower is how I started these steps, but it's the correct aligning of my will with the will of God. That is the essence of step three. I was trying to find out what his will is for me and doing that. So I believed at that point something very simple, and that was I had to write inventory. That's what I was told to do, and that's what I did. I walked out of rehab, and I had this, like, big, like, half-inch knob on that finger, you know, your pencil finger. It took, like, 9 months for that thing to go away, you know? And now it's like, you know, I'm always putting cream there, because I still think that it's there, you know? But I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote. And, you know, I did a rehab inventory, you know, whatever. I was told, you know, to look at 7 different areas of my life and to, you know, figure out what I needed to keep, what I needed to change, and what I needed to get rid of. And that was really, really instrumental for me. One of the things that I suffered from at that time, and I say suffered from, and that was the fact that I was in an abusive alcoholic marriage. So my counselor was very gentle with me, and because she understood that being in the abusive situation I was in, I had a lot of the things that Al-Anons have. And I see that now, because for about 2 years after that, I also went to Al-Anon and participated in Al-Anon family groups, because that was really instrumental for me in looking at both sides of what damage and what soul sickness for me needed to be repaired, and correcting those things and taking the actions that both of those programs, it's the same program, but it comes at it from a different aspect. And for me, that was really important for me to do that, because coming out of an abusive alcoholic marriage, which I did on leaving the rehab at that point, I did get a restraining order against my husband, so that he couldn't come back and keep doing what he had been doing, which for me was another really huge step in recovery, because up until that point I hadn't been willing to make that change, and a lot of this is about change. I did my 5th step with my counselor, and she pointed out a lot of things that I had missed. And like I said, a lot of it had to do with the fact that I was really, 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 really down on myself. I was way over, you know, I know a lot of times when I hear inventory these days, it's more difficult to get the person to see the 4th column in, as it shows in the big book, about where they were selfish or inconsiderate or self-seeking or filled with fear. And basically all I could see was that. You know, I really couldn't see anything about me that was worthwhile at all. I was totally on the other end of the spectrum. And I know now that that too, self-absorption is also a manifestation of ego. So I had to be brought, you know, this program is all about balance and about getting to the middle. Because as people who are alcoholics or Al-Anons, we tend to live at one end of the spectrum or the other. Things are black or they're white. They're good or they're bad. You know, we're either like really excited about something or totally depressed. You know, it's like, you know, and I was way down on one end of that scale, and it was all about coming towards the middle. You know, I could be running around and I could be like, ooh, you know, at a meeting or something, and then, you know, I'd go home and 2 hours later I'd be, you know, nobody loves me, you know, the whole deal. you know, we're like an hour before, you know, I knew I was the star. So, you know, newcomers were like that. But as things progressed, you know, I've been through the step process several times since then. And one of the things that I've noticed as I've done inventory in a 4-column format, which is the way the big book suggests, where we write down all of the people, institutions, and principles with which we are angry. And then we write down why. And then we write down what parts of self are affected. And then we write down where were we at fault? Where were we inconsiderate? Where were we frightened? Where were we self-seeking? Where were we selfish? And I notice one of the best parts about inventory is getting it on paper. because I still have a tendency to kind of just mull things over in my head, you know. And I'll think about it, and I'll think about it, and I'll think about it, and as I think about it, over and over and over and over again, day after day after day, it changes. And you know, I still have a tendency to go back to that, and it's very detrimental to my mental health and my spiritual well-being. So it's really important to get it out on paper and get it out on paper soon, quickly, as soon as something happens. It's even more beneficial that if I know right away, because I have that little, you know, that little thing inside me nowadays, and of course, you know, this is the 10th step, but I have that little thing inside me nowadays that kind of says, oh, you shouldn't have said that, you know, or, ooh, you know, that didn't come out quite right, you know, or maybe I could have done this a little differently, or I could have done this a little better. And if I can do that right away, and, you know, say I'm sorry to the person right away, you know, if I don't let my pride get in the way, if I'm not already pissed at them for something they said to me 2 weeks ago, and now this is just further proof, you know. you know, it's so much better for my spiritual health, because I still do have a tendency to justify myself and, you know, make myself the hero in my own head, at least, you know. And then, of course, I can always, you know, talk to one or the other of my friends on the phone and get them on the wagon with me, too, so, you know. And this is not good, you know. It really isn't. But, you know, it's a truthful program, I'll tell on myself. But one of the things that I really like about the fourth step is that it is a written inventory. And it's an inventory of me, you know. I mean, sure, I'm writing down a whole lot of other people's names and what they did to me. But, you know, it's kind of one of those things that it's interesting, because one of the things that I noticed is that the inventory starts on the outside and it works its way in. You know, like it starts on the outside and says, well, that's the person, that's what they did to me. Now, how did it affect me? Now we're getting down there. And now, really, now, what was really, you know, we're at the emotional level in that, you know, how did it affect me? You know, was it my security? Was it my self-esteem? Was it my social instinct that was, you know, frightened? All those things. And then the next column gets down to the real nut, and that is, what did I do to set these things in motion? You know, is there anything that I could have done differently? Because that's the part that's going to make my life better. If I could stop doing the things that eventually cause these outward circumstances, then I can begin to heal. And that's really how we heal, because we heal on the inside first, you know. As an alcoholic, I needed to take a whole bunch of actions before I really started to notice how much I was healing on the inside. And the beginning of that, of course, was the action of the decision. Because that is an action, you know? Because that's when we actually set our willpower in motion and say, this is what I'm going to do, this is my course of action, this is my plan. Because you can't ever get out on a course of action without a plan. And the great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is we've got this whole system in place. You know, it's like walking into a successful company and then plopping you down and saying, this is all you have to do, and you can be a success too. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous does for us. You know, we've got a plan. All you have to do is follow these instructions to the letter, do everything they say, do everything we say, do everything we did, and you can be a success too. You know? And, you know, it's a great system. It's a great system for success. And I began to heal on the inside, you know. These wounds began to heal, basically because of the changes that I started to make in how I approached other people. Because if on a day-to-day basis I don't cause other people to hurt me anymore, you know. And then, of course, in the later steps, you know, going out and repairing the damage of the past that I've done to other people, you know, my life gets better around me. And the other part of it is that growing in understanding and love and consideration of other people, and understanding, you know, as Mike opens the meeting with, you know, the other people may be sick too, is, you know, growing in love and understanding that in the fifth step with my sponsor, sitting there, and, you know, she tells me these little stories about things that she did that were just like that, or if I am stuck in a situation, I can't really see what my part was, she'll say, you know, well, this happened to me, and this is what I figured out, you know, this is what I found out about it, and sharing that with another person, because there's a whole lot about me that I don't see, because I am so emotionally involved in me, you know, and even though my sponsor, you know, at this point, it's been a few years, she gets a little emotionally involved in me, too, she has a little bit more. She has a little bit more of an ability to kind of sit back and look at me objectively and say, "Well, you know." Have you thought that maybe? My stepsister up here is really laughing. you know, so that's the benefit of doing a fifth step with another person. And of course, the other beautiful part about the fifth step is, you know, the God part. It's real important that we remember, and I'll speak to this from the sponsor perspective because it's my personal experience with it. I can't speak about my sponsor's experience with this, but I really strongly feel in the fifth step that I'm there to be an instrument for God. I take hearing fifth steps very seriously. One of the things that I do is I have the women that I sponsor. I work with them pretty closely through the big book, looking at the directions, following the directions very closely, all the way through them writing their fourth step. And when it comes time for me to hear their fifth step, we'll look at our calendars and we'll pick a weekend. And I have the woman come over to my house and spend the weekend with me because I don't know how long the inventory is going to take. And it seems that a lot of the women that I have sponsored, this is the first time they've ever done a four-column inventory out of the big book. A lot of people seem to, you know, I don't know, you know, where a lot of people have written life stories maybe, or they've been in the program for a while and they've never actually done the steps. One of the gals I'm sponsoring now has more time than me, and she did like a life story kind of inventory. And I read the form that was used, and it actually concluded with the second step proposition. Either God is or he isn't. And I'm like, wait a minute. That didn't move you forward. That took you back. You know? But I don't know how long the inventory is going to take, so I set aside a whole weekend. And I've been finding that generally the resentments take all of Saturday. I have this this lazy boy that Kathy really likes, and it's got like the vibrating and the heat in it, you know. That's really helpful, you know. if you've been here at inventory for like 12, 14, 16 hours, and it's like, you know, okay, all right, now this is your ex-husband, okay, I'll give you 12 on him. Pick the best, pick the top 12, you know. You know, but I try not to limit it because I don't know. You know, and one of our friends, Mary Beth, says, you know, she has been in enough therapy to know that when you're listening to a sponsee, they usually won't get around to the really important thing until the last minute of the hour. You know, and it's like sometimes you have to call them back and say, did you ever tell me what you really wanted to say? You know, so it's usually around, you know, 1 or 2 a.m. on Saturday night that I finally find out, you know, and it's like, you know, my head's spinning. So then on Sunday morning, we'll get up and we'll do the fear inventory and the sex inventory. And then I'll ask them to spend their quiet hour at my house. That's how I hear inventory. And I take it really seriously, and I really prepare a lot ahead of time spiritually through prayer and meditation, because I think that the most important thing for me when I hear a fifth step is that I get me out of the way. Because hearing a fifth step is so important to be able to do what my sponsor was able to do for me, and that was to help me to change. Because the truth of the matter is that my old belief system wasn't working for me anymore. I wasn't happy the way I was, the way I was living my life, the way I was doing what I was doing, and all the things that I believed about me and about you didn't work. And that's why my life was unmanageable. So those things have to change. And if my problem is that I'm human too. So when I'm hearing a fifth step, I'll be sitting with someone who I really, at this point, because we've been spending a lot of time together, I really probably like a lot. And I really want, you know, I'm not perfect. You know, I'm not like, I haven't risen beyond that, like spiritual, into that spiritual level. I want her to like me too. You know, and it's important for me to have God get me out of the way. Because there's going to be some things that I'm going to say to her that she doesn't want to hear necessarily. Or that God's going to have to say to her. And I'm going to be the instrument. And it's not easy. It's not easy, you know. Because, you know, I spent a whole lot of time in my life. One of my survival skills that worked for me the longest was, you know, if you liked me, then I could get what I wanted, you know. And today I have to realize that, you know, this is somebody's life. You know, and this is their happiness, and this is their joy. And if I can't get me out of the way, God's not going to be able to do what he needs to do. So one of the things I've noticed after hearing fifth steps is that I forget a lot of what I hear, which I think is a blessing. Note for the tape, the rolling of the eyes. And sometimes, you know, one of the gals that I sponsor will say to me, well, remember I told you about my sister Janice or blah, 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 blah. And I'll be like, huh? What? Oh, yeah. I see some identification in the crowd. But in hearing fifth steps for me in the beginning, it was really difficult because I used to take it all in. And it really was, you know, a couple times I was pretty close to a state of depression afterwards because I really took on all of that sorrow and all of the woe and all of the hurt that this person was expressing to me. For the first time, they felt safe, you know, safe enough to know that they can say whatever needs to be said. And they've got all the time they want to say what needs to be said, and any way they want to say it, it doesn't matter, because it's what they are inventorying about themselves. And that's the important part, is they need to know that they're in a space where they are safe and they're loved and it's okay, and they don't have anything to gain, you know, other than that they're going to be released of this finally, and that they can be changed, that they don't have to be that way anymore. And that's the essence of it, you know, is providing a safe environment for that person. Because it's so important that breathe a word of what I tell them. Because there's some things that I still think and do that I'm not proud of. And I need to have that person that I can go to who knows enough about me, who knows my past history, who knows my patterns, who knows my behaviors, and I can go to her and I can say, well, guess what? And she'll go, yeah. And I can spill my guts, you know, and I don't have to worry about being judged. I don't have to worry about being scorned or punished, but that I can get good direction, because I know that she's a woman of God also, and she's walking on the path, and she's going to do the best she can to help me to continue to become where I need to be, where I can be best of service. And that's what the essence of all this is, you know, is to fit myself to be of maximum service to my concept of God and to my fellow man. And I do that primarily in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I also do it in my family, and I also do it in the outside world, at work, you know, whoever I run into. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, all the simple things that we have to change, you know, once we get through that fifth step, you know, we get pointed out to us all of these patterns of our lives so that we can start to recognize them ourselves. You know, like the perfect example of this pendulum for me would be in my sex life. I always went for like that really, like I said, I married the best drinking partner I ever had. We lived the fast life. We lived the good life. And it was chaos because being an alcoholic, his mood swings were up and down and up and down and up and down. And being in that relationship and knowing and being of the mindset at that time that I needed to fit myself into that relationship as best I could, I was going up and down and up and down and up and down with him. And after getting sober, I found that, you know, I kept seeking that out. Even though I didn't have the drinking part anymore, I kept seeking that out in a man. And after doing my sex inventory the last time, I wrote my sex ideal, which I think is one of the biggest benefits of doing your fourth step and your fifth step. I wrote mine subsequent to my fifth step. It's actually in the fourth step instructions, the instructions for the sex ideal. It says, you know, once we come up with, I don't remember the exact wording in the book, but it says that we need to come up with basically a design for living and decide how we can best, who we want to be, who God wants us to be in our relationships so that we can best serve his purpose. And that includes my behavior, that includes who I think would be the best partner for me based on my past mistakes, and also what I want, what I think an ideal relationship would be. And I wrote all this stuff out. And I started dating a non-alcoholic for the first time ever. Ooh, that was like really wild. Not wild in the sense that like now this is like this wild, chaotic relationship, but it's not. And like everything's like real calm and thought out, and you know, I guess this is what normal is. You know, it's to me it was really odd though at the beginning. You know, like, you know, this person doesn't like talk a lot, or you know, like when I would start to talk, he wouldn't like cut in the middle of the sentence. Because he thought of something he needed to say at that particular moment, it just came out of his mouth. You know, I mean, there's like all these like little things that I had to get used to that were really, you know, strange. You know, so that was one of the benefits of the whole process for me was my sex ideal. Because I strongly recommend that that everyone write one, because it really can be a design for any relationship. I mean, I wrote down all the things that I thought I need to be in a love relationship. And I kind of look at it now and then, and I think now it's kind of broadened itself, you know, and I know that if I could be all of those things, other than a couple of things, for obvious reasons. All of those things, you know, in my relationships with my friends, with my sponsor, with, you know, my sponsor's husband, with all the people that I meet, if I can act that way, that my relationships with other people will be better also, you know, because, you know, there's things like being considerate, being, thinking of the other person, trying to, you know, put myself in their shoes. You know, a list like that of all the things that I think that I need to be and need to act like in a love relationship. And also, if I can carry that into my other relationships, that really is a good design for living for me, as far as, you know, characteristics that I need to look for in myself. And they basically came out of my sex inventory, because I could see all the things that I had done wrong in my sex relationships. And for me, that was the epitome, probably because it's like the only things I could really remember. I don't know. I had a lot of blackouts. But, you know, the men sort of stood out. You know, I could see really clearly there the things that I had done to harm other people, you know, because those were the relationships where I actually did let people close to me, because I wasn't letting women close to me at all, you know, in the end. I mean, most of my drinking career, as I like to call it, I was, I didn't have a lot of women friends, because you were the competition. So I really need to look closely at that sex inventory to see where my, you know, when I'm in a relationship where I'm supposed to be close to somebody, and I, you know, in theory, I love this person, how I treated them, and what I need to change. You know, so that really, you know, that sex idea really gave me a good design for living. But I strongly recommend writing an inventory if you haven't done it, as soon as possible. Don't let it take too long, because there isn't a really worse place to be than to be in the middle of inventory. I was with a sponsee last night, and she said to me, you know, I started writing my inventory, because I had told her to write the whole list of people, institutions, and principles to do the first column, just like the instruction in the book. And then I said, and then go on and just take a fresh piece of paper and write that person's name at the top and start writing the clauses. And she had gotten herself on a schedule because she felt like she wasn't doing it fast enough, or she wasn't getting to it during the day. So she said she was going to do two people a day. And she noticed about 3 or 4 days into it that she started to get really depressed. And I said, she said, do you think it has anything to do with the fourth step? And I said, well, did you pray afterwards for God to take you out of that space? And she went, no, I completely forgot about that instruction. Because one of the things that I tell, that I instruct the women that I work with to do, is to pray for God to help you to see what it is you need to see. Because like I said, a lot of the women that I work with are not newcomers necessarily, they're recomers, as I call them. Or maybe they didn't actually drink, but they're new to me. This is the first time I've gone through inventory with them, and they've done inventory before, so there's no need for them to go back and inventory everything all over again if they already inventoried it and made amends. But to go through what it is they need to see today, you know, and this is what I do when I do inventories now. I pray for God to show me what it is that I need to see. And then when I get done, when I feel like, you know, I'm sort of empty and I've done enough writing for that session, whatever that may be, I pray for him to take me out of that space. Because I've gone to enough AA meetings where I hear people say, I'm doing my four-step inventory right now, and you know, I found out, and they go on for another 15 minutes on something that really needs to be said in a fifth step with their sponsor, you know? And an AA meeting isn't really the kind of place where you get appropriate feedback on that kind of stuff. And the other thing is, you don't want to stay in that space either. You want God to take you out of that mindset. You know, it's like you put down what you need to put down for that day, and then you come out of that frame of mind. Because otherwise, something will happen, like happened to my friend, you know, last week, you know, where she ends up kind of dwelling in that mental state of thinking, of dwelling about that second column. And that's going to do nothing but bring you down. So that's another thing that I instruct the women that I work with to do, is to pray to come out of the space. But I think that the fifth step for me is really important, and I think from that, for me, was really the beginning of the growth of trusting you. I just want to say that. That promise for me really came true. There's some fifth step promises in the book, and one of them that I remember coming strongly true for me immediately was when I was sitting home in my apartment, and I had gotten a restraining order against my husband, so he wasn't there. I was alone, and for the first time ever, I was sitting there without the stereo on, without the TV blaring, not being on the phone. I could hear the neighbors outside, you know, they were partying or doing whatever they were doing, and it didn't bother me. I was at peace. I felt peace and contentment inside my own skin, alone. And for me, that was such a beautiful result. And that was the first time I can ever remember being that way, being okay within my own skin. And gradually the other promises also came true for me. And, you know, that feeling of release and that feeling that, you know, I was walking, you know, on this path with other people, that it was okay to open up finally, because I had been so closed for so long. And, you know, having that feeling that, you know, here in AA, it was okay because other people understood and they had the same experiences I had, you know. And that was a beautiful result of the fifth step for me also. And that continues to grow for me each time I go through the process. So I'll close with that. Thanks for letting me share.